Welcome to CSIS. I'm Kathleen Hicks. I direct the International Security Program, and together with Pete Daly at USNI, we host this Maritime Security Dialogue with the support of Lockheed Martin and Huntington Ingalls Industries, and we want to thank them for their support of this series. Before I begin the session today, I just want to remind everyone that we have some safety precautions in the building. If a fire alarm or something like that goes off, directly behind the audience here are exits that lead out to Rhode Island Avenue, and there are also exits behind me that lead back behind the building toward National Geographic, and just follow my lead should an alarm go off. Today's discussion is a very important one in our series. It's about building the 350-ship Navy, which is a much discussed, of course, all of you know, topic these days, both the prospects for doing so and the challenges in reaching that goal. We are discussing this today with three very distinguished former secretaries of the Navy. I have to my immediate left, you perhaps have never been described as being to the immediate left.
I can't remember, ever.
Former Democratic appointee. So this is a first.
Feeling very comfortably to the right of my colleagues here.
The Honorable John Layman Jr. served as the 65th Secretary of the Navy for 6 years during the Ronald Reagan administration, from 1981 to 1987. He's currently the chairman of J.F. Layman & Company, a private equity investment firm in New York that he founded in 1990. Next, we have the Honorable Sean O'Keefe, who served as the 69th Secretary of the Navy from 1992 to 1993 during the George H.W. Bush administration. He is currently a university professor and the Fansteel Chair in Strategic Management and Leadership at the Syracuse University Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs, and he is also a distinguished senior advisor here at CSIS. And finally, we have the Honorable Richard Danzig, who served as the 71st Secretary of the Navy from 1998 to 2001 during the Bill Clinton administration. Dr. Danzig is currently a senior advisor to the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, a consultant to IARPA, chair of the advisory panel for Idaho National Labs Innovation Center, and a member of the Toyota Research Institute Advisory Board. Thank you all three for coming to share your thoughts today. So 276 ships now. Trump administration, or Trump as a candidate, had a goal of 350. The Chief of Naval Operations says to meet the demand signal that he sees out there, he needs 355 ships. I think starting very broadly, if I can just go down the line, beginning with you, Secretary Layman, should we in fact have a goal for our Navy to reach 350, 355 ships? And if so, how do we get there?
Well, I hope none of you have an important afternoon here, because I think this is going to be a pretty long session. Where does 350 come from? Well, demand signal is kind of a swamp term of art. The fact is that in the reforms that have been made over the last 30 years, the Navy really doesn't have too much say in where they go and for how long. It's the COCOMs, the combatant commanders, that really rule the forces. And when they say we got to have three carriers out in the Western Pacific for this particular period, the Navy has to salute and go. And that, by the way, is what is shaping up as at least a permanent two with ability to surge to three. Well, it's not just the carriers. And by the way, three use up basically the whole fleet of carriers, because in the sustainable 1-to-3 ratio, and we really only have 9 deployables right now, so you can only keep forward deployed with a sustainable cycle, three forward. So they're all going to be in the Pacific. Well, of course, the Atlantic has something to say about that, and EUCOM has something to say, and CENTCOM has something to say. So in fact, they're going to be a continuing requirement for 5 carriers forward, as far ahead as we can see. So it's not just, you know, a carrier. A carrier doesn't go out alone, as everybody knows. In the Cold War days, we deployed battle groups, and the average battle group had about 25 ships in it. And you needed that many for the submarine threat You go into a high threat area, you've got to have a lot of tails in the water, a lot of active sonar, a lot of helos, and that takes, and you have to have your underway replenishment ships and cruisers, you have to have your anti-air capability. Well, when the Cold War ended, the Navy shifted to what are now called strike groups. And the reason they're not called battle groups is they can't do battle in a high threat area because they deploy normally with about 5 additional ships instead of 25. And that's because we don't have any more. And so that's why it's so silly to, you know, it could only happen in the swamp, that debate about whether we should have readiness or more ships, because they're inseparable. The reason we have such readiness problems is that the ships are being run, to mix a metaphor, into the ground. And we've seen this cycle a number of times before in the 20th century. We know where it ends, and we're at that point now. The good people leave. You don't have the people ready to train the watchstanders who are experienced. You don't have the spare parts. You never really deploy fully combat ready because you're out at sea. As soon as you come back in, you've got to turn around, refuel, and go out again. And so it really has degraded the quality and the combat capability. I mean, as everybody's read in the paper, just the ship driving training and experience level has really degraded throughout the surface fleet. It's not just the Pacific fleet. And that doesn't even get to the much more difficult training and experience, which is in the CIC, in the combat capability, dealing with the multiple threats in a really operational exercise and so forth. That's even more degraded than the readiness. And it's because we don't have enough ships, because the ships don't have time back in home port to do the necessary training, to check the boxes, to see that everybody's qualified, to restock the spare parts, to get the repairs done in pierside availabilities. So the two are inseparable. The number of ships is an inherent part of readiness. Fewer ships, worse readiness. There's no way to cut it. Now, you could say, well, give the Navy the power again, which they once had, to say, hell no, we won't go. We're not going to go. We're not ready. Well, that means you could do that, and that is just take the fleet we have, forget about building it in size, and concentrate on restocking the spare parts and the training and so forth. But you'd have to drop either the Persian Gulf or the Mediterranean or the North Atlantic or Western Pacific to do that. And the COCOMs won't let the Navy do that. So the Navy is caught really in the middle. So that's the reason the 350 is the number. Can we get there? Of course we can get there. I mean, in World War II, we fought the whole war in 3.5 years and started with a very small Navy and ended up with 5,000 ships and 105 carriers using the counting rules we have. And we did that in 3.5 years, mainly. There wasn't a single capital ship that fought in World War II that, or carrier rather, that wasn't designed and built starting with the 1936 Shipbuilding Act. So all that was done. And of course, everybody said at the time, if you read the literature at the time, you can't do this, it's impossible. We can't build that many ships. Well, we ended up building 5,000 ships in 3.5 years. So of course we can do it. There's so much nonsense talked about industrial base. Well, we don't have the industrial base we have now. I think we have a better industrial base I mean, since I entered the buyout business, I've owned four shipyards, all of which built naval ships at one time, one of them the Iowa battleship. And we made very good profit, but we did no Navy shipbuilding at all, none. And that's true of a lot of the marine industrial base. They're out of the business. The duopoly of General Dynamics and HII, pretty much, except for the LCS, is a duopoly. And trying to crack into that is not practical. So industrial base arguments, I think, are silly. The industrial base will respond to whatever it is obviously and seriously happening. It doesn't mean they're going to respond just because an administration happens to say, oh, we're going to build a 350-ship Navy. They've got to see, industry has to see that there is a commitment, that the money is in the budget, that OMB supports it, that the committees in Congress and a bipartisan majority supports it. All those factors are present today. So yes, of course we can build it, and we can build it fast. There are a lot of interesting issues about whether we should reactivate ships. Mm-hmm. We did that in the Reagan administration. We reactivated a lot of ships, not the carriers that we originally thought we were going to do, because they were too far gone. But we reactivated battleships, we reactivated destroyers, we reactivated a lot of support ships, and we built 25 ships off the balance sheet. All those pre-positioning ships in Diego Garcia and Guam were built off balance sheet in a very cost-effective way. So that's why we were able to average 28 ships a year throughout the administration.
Well, so we're going to come back, I think, on a number of the, you have very well set up, I think, a number of the issues in terms of bringing things up off all the industrial base issues, the financing issues. But let me go down the line, and if I can get Secretary O'Keefe's view next on whether this is a goal to aim for, and generally speaking, if so, how we get there.
Appreciate that. Well, first and foremost, I want to recognize one of the most distinguished former secretaries, Secretary Warner, Senator Warner. Thank you so much for being here. It's I don't think we're going to offer anything here that would be a fraction of what you could do by yourself. So we're going to do our best to try to accommodate to that. I fully agree that in John's proposition that 350 ships or any number you choose is a bumper sticker. It's descriptive of whatever is the derivative of the strategy that you determine is the appropriate configuration to project power, to have the capability in order to demonstrate the force of the United States around the globe. At present, at last I'm advised, there's 7 of the 11 carrier groups are deployed now. Now, that number does not equate to 350. It would have to be substantially different than that, depending on what kind of configuration you want, what kind of, as John described, whether it's a battle group, a strike group, or whatever you're gonna formulate, it becomes the formulation of that particular strategy, which is yet to be really articulated in this administration. So as a consequence, at this juncture, 350 is a notional figure that is no different than an earlier point in which we have targeted some number as emblematic or indicative or descriptive of the broader strategy. In this case, that's not there. What we're seeing, though, by action is a effort to consistently, as over the course of history, and John's description of that is absolutely dead on, that there is not a lot of argument about once is a determination on the part of the National Command Authority, which is defined as the President of the United States. Once that's determined that yes, indeed, we are going to project force in order to demonstrate the intent of the United States, then there is no Secretary of Defense or Chairman of the Joint Chiefs who will advise the President that, nope, sorry, we can't do that right now, we're too busy. So until and unless that kind of configuration shifts, where there's a cause and effect that's established on something like this, whatever that number is going to be hard to justify given the circumstances of what's involved. This is as good a, bottom line is, this is as good a target as any as you could conceive, but starting with the wrong premise. It's not a count, it's a derivative of what the strategy ought to be. Second point, I think, is right on. The industrial capacity is not the limitation. This could certainly, it'd be great enthusiasm from the existing industrial capacity out there, so you bet we could do that. We could name that goal of 350 in two notes and, you know, accomplish it quickly, all that. That said, the greater limitation is going to be on the capacity to actually determine what the configuration will call for in terms of human resources, manpower, capability to crew the vessels. And how you'd go about doing so is going to be a trick, in part, not because there's a paucity of folks who would enlist or, you know, think about it, although that's an ever-ending kind of challenge that has to be wrestled with regularity. The greater challenge is going to be how much of that it consumes of the resources that are available. And at present time, relative to John's tenure as secretary, we're now looking at a period when half of the budget of the, you know, the Defense Department, and by derivative, the Navy Department as well, is consumed with supporting people, the cost to pay them, to house them, to health care, everything else that goes along with that. It, in the going-in proposition, half the cost or more is derived from that particular feature. So for each time you decide you're going to increase this, you've got to significantly increase the overall resource allocation to that. And at the current historic levels of defense spending that we're experiencing today, this is going to be challenging, no question. Because something else then becomes a consequence of that if the continuing zero-sum game argument on Capitol Hill continues. So this is going to be an interesting dynamic. There's no doubt about it. It's whether this can be attained for a multitude of different reasons, but among them are those two primary factors. The absence, really, of a clear strategy and objective of how you derive that, and secondly, how you'd actually go about the process of assuring that the crew capacity is there to do so, and that they're trained, exactly as John alluded, in a manner in which the operational capabilities are at a higher peak. We've seen the consequence of this in recent months of what the tragedy of that will yield sometimes as a result of that tempo of operations that really stresses the force. So all those factors, I think, have become part of this, and in some ways, the answer to that, I'm hopeful, is going to be derived by the strategic review that Secretary Spencer has initiated to look at that broader set of strategic systemic challenges that are engaged in operational matters, which will then in turn inform this question as well.
Secretary Danzig, your thoughts.
Well, I also am delighted to be here. These two of my most illustrious predecessors, a third. John was always immensely helpful to me by offering advice, good advice, whenever asked. Sean would offer advice even when not asked. Sometimes I had the feeling, could I just take the beer, Sean? But I've always listened to these.
It cost me to invite him to advice. Yeah.
I've always listened to these two gentlemen, and you're wise to do so. That said, I was glad that Kath began by giving you instructions about how to respond to the fire alarm and how to evacuate. Because I'm going to differ in the point of view with respect to the central proposition being offered here, and some of you may want to evacuate, and it may create some fires. It's not that I disagree at all with the notion that a bigger Navy is undesirable. A bigger Navy is highly desirable, and we ought to do what we can to get more resources for the Navy. And I think John and Sean are quite right that we're all struck by how overstretched the present environment is. But what we choose as our rallying cry here and where we choose to put our focus is an absolutely critical issue. and putting it on 350 or 355 ships as a building program seems to me to put the stress in the wrong place, put the emphasis in the wrong place. Indeed, it creates stresses of a variety of kinds. It's not a matter of indifference, I think, what that rallying cry is. What you measure is what you motivate. Where you put your dollars is a strong indication of what your priorities are. There's a natural tendency in all the services to point to platforms. They're measurable. This on October 27th, hey, these are very complex times and more complex, he said, than we've had for the last 70 years. Where you put your priorities is an absolutely critical question. And there's an instinctive gut inclination to put those priorities where John Layman and Sean have argued for. Sandy Winnefeld, Admiral Winnefeld, I thought made an important kind of warning statement in his recent FCA speech. And just to quote from one public quotation of it, additionally, talk of a plus up triggers an overwhelming temptation to grow force structure without careful consideration as to the exact kinds of personnel, Sean's point, or platforms first. For example, the Army's identity metric is soldiers. For the Navy, it is ships. And he says, we know that managing to the wrong metric can cause really bad behaviors, and service identity metrics are real doozies. So you all, as a Navy audience, see this very clearly in the Army and the Air Force, but it's a lot harder to see it with the Navy. Because we're inside it and we all care so much about it. But I think there are three fundamental problems with the focus on building structure. I entirely agree with John and Sean that it's not industrial base. We could do this if that's where we want our emphasis. The first problem is the one Sean touches on, personnel. We know that our personnel are extraordinarily overstretched. It's part of the point that's being made here. But a building program only increases demands for personnel. And I think the implication of proponents is, well, the personnel will follow. But really, the personnel are, to begin with, the key thing. And we ought to be talking about them. We oughtn't to make it the tugboat behind the carrier that we care about. We ought to say, this is square one, what we care about. And we need it now, that kind of attention, and we need it more urgently than a building program which necessarily will take us over the next 20, 25 years and increase stresses. John correctly points out that the stresses derive from the Navy's can-do attitude, the inability to say no, and the constant demand from COCOMs. But my basic premise is the demand from the COCOMs will always exceed the availability of ships. Build me a stronger Navy, I will have stronger demand. And to me, therefore, all I'm going to do if I sign up for this metric is exacerbate an underlying problem, and hopefully we can talk more about that problem. Mm-hmm. Second is basic technology innovation. A number of people have argued, and everybody in the room has varying degrees of familiarity with it, but some awareness of it, that technological innovation is crucial. Unmanned vehicles, both subsurface, surface, and aviation, cyber warfare kinds of issues, issues associated with artificial intelligence, issues associated with changing technologies, even hypersonic weapons. We don't deal with those issues by structure. And when we add to structure, we add to the number of targets that are in many dimensions quite vulnerable. We need to concentrate on those issues. It's not that I don't care about structure. It's not that a Navy of 350 ships wouldn't be a good thing. But I want to focus on personnel, and I want to focus on technology as my priorities before I get to that. And the third, and make that, as Sean suggests, a kind of derivative number. The third thing is the high-low mix. Some people are recognizing that in our present circumstance, we have huge incentives to have the Navy out there everywhere, John's point. We also have incentives to build ships for the numbers rather than for ultimately their warfighting capabilities. There is, as many people have observed, power in numbers, particularly in peacetime or in modest littoral conflict kinds of situations where more numbers add to more power. But fundamentally, the rationale for the Navy and the importance of the Navy to this republic is the ability to fight if and when we get into a major conflict. And it's the ability to deter that major conflict because we're so dominant in that arena. But if you raise the flag of 350 or 355 ships as the measure of our well-being, and we put it out there as what we want above all, we will motivate people to build more and more at the low end and less at the high end. And it's the high end capability we need for that fundamental contingency. So my suggestion is it's easy to sign up for this, but the warning sign from John McCain and from Sandy Winnefeld is think about where your real priority lies. And my suggestion is your real priorities should lie with the personnel, with the technology, and with the capability for fundamental warfighting. And 350 ships or 355 distracts from that priority and points us in the wrong direction in terms of ultimately the kind of balance we need to achieve. So I lay that out as a dissenting view with huge respect for the advocates, not only because they're people of such quality and secretaries of such quality, but because it's manifested by caring about the same thing we care about, all of us, which is a stronger Navy. But I think you've got a particular responsibility as people outside the administration who are knowledgeable about the Navy to speak about what actually will be best for the Navy. People on the inside have a variety of inhibitions about speaking out in anything that would appear to be a criticism of the standard. So I call on all of us to, hopefully in this discussion, fulfill that responsibility.
Great. Well, we indeed should have scheduled, as Secretary Lehman pointed out, perhaps hours here, not because those were long, but because it was a very rich lay down of the many issues. I know we're not going to be able to get to all of them, which I'm regretting. Let me come back to Secretary Lehman and ask you, one of the things that you mentioned is the political, sort of the stars have aligned, if you will. A concern that many people have in any capital intensive service, certainly the Navy in this time frame, is this, the degree to which we can sustain commitment and the uncertainty of the environment also geopolitically in terms of what are the types of capabilities we might need 20 years down the road, et cetera. I know you made a point to say we can build quickly, but presumably we have to have a sustainable approach over time. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about how we should be thinking, not so much the number, but thinking about the platforms and how they intersect these issues of manning or personnel, technology, and if we're going to increase our ship build substantially, where should we focus our attention when it comes to those platforms?
Well, first of all, we found in the Reagan administration that when the 600-ship Navy was laid out, and with no stinting of readiness and technology and so forth, that within 6 months, we were unable to cope with all of the recruiting, the people that came to sign up, because personnel is driven in the military services by people that, the view that they're going to be part of a winner. And that's, in 1980, that was not the feeling. We were hemorrhaging. Ships couldn't sail because people were leaving. They were not staying in, but the best, particularly when they could, in the technology emphasis of the Navy, we had trained people that could get jobs anywhere in the economy. It's the same today. So you can't put the tugboat before the carrier, because if you commit as a nation to rebuild the deterrent capability of the naval forces, and you're not going to abandon allies, and you will go not with six ships, but sufficient ships to prevail against the threat, then the people flock to. For 3 years after Top Gun, we had three times the number of qualified applicants for naval aviation that we had. So if you project that the Navy is going to be they have command of the seas again, the people will flock to join, and qualified people, top quality people. Technology, And again.
Could I just ask you, how many people would you increase the Navy by if you got to 355 ships? What increment would you like in personnel?
I don't think we need a big end strength increase, because part of what we have to do is to reduce all of the unrestricted line people, sailors and officers, that are wasting their time in the 270 joint task forces that were created so they could meet the 4-year staff duty requirement that Goldwater Nichols put in. So if we just apply common sense to that nonsensical requirement, you would have a flood of seagoing sailors to put into operational billets. And it's not just that. I mean, all of the service staffs have had to continually grow to deal with the tremendous steady growth of the 970,000 FTEs in the civilian part of the bureaucracy. So I don't foresee a significant increase. As you said, as you build modern technology ships, you don't have to have the 1,300 people we needed for the battleship. You can use technology. I think some of the pie-in-the-sky planners have gone way too far on the LCS, for instance, because if you look at the Fig 7s, the Stark and the Roberts had tremendous battle damage, but the ship was built to withstand damage, and they protected the crew, and then the crew saved the ship because there were large enough crews so that they could survive, fight and survive. So it's not that much of an obstacle. One last thing on the technology issue that you raised.
Thank you.
Today, technology, we were used in the Cold War to having a permanent edge in technology, partially because the Russians adopted a policy after World War II to draft behind our technology. So they designed their fighters to use the F-18 radar, because they knew, as you remember the movie Falcon and the Snowman, they knew they would be able to steal it. And their AMRAAM missile just awaited the final production of development of our AMRAAM, then they put it right in. Well, today it's much worse. That gave us in those days, in the Cold War, a permanent lead time. We were always superior. Our technology was always better because the Soviets were always parasiting on ours. Today, their cyber is so capable, even though most of the defense industry will not publicly admit it, but they're right in from the beginning of the program in their cyber capability, so that there is almost no lead, lag. They're not behind us. They're with us in our technology. So if you look at their cycle times now, if you look at their latest submarines, it's pretty hard to project a real advantage sub to sub between the latest versions of the Soviet subs that have copied all of the technology of our submarine quieting, and they're ahead in some of the more offensive capabilities. So we can't count on that permanent lag. So we have really, I think, fallen behind on technology generally, and we've got to get back in that game. But there are ships. There's still a need for a high-low mix. To me, the issue of whether we should reactivate FIGs is purely one of ASW. It would be foolish to try to make them a three-dimensional combat platform. The battle groups, if they're going to get into an area where you're threatened by either the Chinese now, they're still pretty far behind the Russians, or the Russians, you better have closer to 20 to 25 ships than you have 5, which we have now. You've got to have those tails in the water. You have to have more helicopters out there, and that's what the FIGs can do. But somebody else is going to have to protect them from missiles and other things. So you don't have to make everything the way the bureaucracy wants to make it, capable of the best technology in every sphere. So I think all of these are solvable, and they're all totally integrated. It's not, you can't do one and not the other.
Secretary O'Keefe, I want to pick on your background at OMB and also the way you framed up initially this sort of the need to link to strategy and where we're going. When we've had major builds before, we've done it, if you know, one could say with some debt, with some revenue increases to the government. We're in an environment right now where at least as we stand today, there you don't have an alignment between Congress and the administration or across parties on how to create new revenue or to bring down spending significantly. How do we get to this problem set of improving naval capability, putting aside again even the issue of 350 ships, but improving naval capability in a budget environment that looks quite tough?
There's no question. I think the greatest challenge going forward here is trying to reconcile just the broader spending objectives and budgeting objectives of what the administration and the Congress are signing up to. There is, between this, the tax measure being introduced, all of this is basically an abandonment of the proposition that there's going to be a near term, even within the most optimistic objectives, if you buy into that, a decade from now proposition in which we're looking at a balanced budget. So this is going to continue to put pressure on every segment of federal spending. And the continuing partisan debate over, for every dollar of defense spending, there's got to be a dollar of domestic spending, or else you won't get the majority necessary in order to move this across. That's going to be a continuing battle and debate as well. So as long as it stays as a zero-sum game, there's going to be real tension. And this year, the aberration is, what Secretary, or I should say Chairman McCain has pulled together, is an amazing capability in order to move this outside of the realm of what would be considered a standard, fist fight over single digit increases that would be involved for defense. This time, I think he's looking at a real substantial shift in that. But even there, the appetite, to borrow a point that I think that Richard introduced, the appetite will expand to fill the amount that's available to do so, and it inevitably is
to
going to be to exceed it, to exceed it every time as well. But it will immediately fill it and then in turn reset objectives that are beyond that. And right now, I think this is past the stage where there is any partisan or bipartisan or any other variation rationality to what the limits could be in these cases. And the abandonment, what appears to be, of the goal of looking at least maintaining a balanced budget objective within a reasonable forecast, is now putting us in a position in which this is going to be a regular fist fight among every constituency.
Could I just add on the budget?
Sure.
I'm happy to answer whatever skeptical question you have prepared
for me,
but I
Go
just
ahead.
Want to... I think what's striking to me is not the amount that we spend on military, it's how much we spend on other things that could be allocated to a more robust military posture if we had the will. We spend a little under 5% of GDP on our national military. We spend 17% on healthcare. Now, I recognize it's nice to get applause for this.
for those joining online, there's applause in another room. I understand that.
An economist put it sort of nicely when he said, think about the United States as a giant healthcare corporation that happens to have an army. Our expenditures are, in many respects, out of whack. Now, this isn't a panel about healthcare, and undoubtedly, we'd have our differences about it. But I think we'd probably all agree that we're spending so much on it relative to what we receive by way of benefit that the potential for gains in that regard should be liberating with the potential to spend money on other things, including the things all of us in this room hugely care about. So I just wanted to add that.
I'm going to, I do have one last question to you, then I want to turn the floor over to Senator Warner, let him say a few words, and then we'll open it up more broadly to the audience. But I wanted to come back, you used a quote from Admiral Winnefeld, who I think everybody knows has tried to focus energy around the how, the innovation and the ways of doing business. If we could get there, I think we would all love to square the circle of the budget to need or projected need mismatch that I suspect is widely shared in this audience. Do you, and you mentioned technology, Secretary Danzig, whether it's unmanned or other kinds of technologies, where do you see the most hope or promise for the Navy, whether on technology and or on operational concepts that are emergent that might be able to use such technology to help the Navy grow its capability?
Yeah. Well, it's a big topic. I think there are huge amounts of opportunity, just to pick a few. I think that what we're seeing is an increased capability to hit with precision from extreme distances. And this, I think, poses huge problems for the Navy, but also has huge potential. Instead of needing to be within eyesight, we move to a world of munitions where we could be at standoff at some considerable distance. And now we're moving to the point where we can stand off at hundreds and thousands of miles. The great articulator of this in recent times has been former Deputy Secretary Bob Work, and I recommend his Bernstein lecture to you, just given down the block a bit ago, as a good articulation of this point of view. So improvements in precision as an offensive matter and in ability to launch from range also require improvements in sensors for observation about where you are. And I put a lot of technology effort into that. I would put a lot of technology effort into how do we disguise our ships, stealth kinds of issues. Anything on the surface of the Earth is a reasonable target in this day and age. What do I do with a Navy in that context? And technological answers are demanded for that. And it isn't a question of generating more ships, it's a question of better covering what we have. I want to come back to the personnel point in the technology context. Right. I think John and I would agree that there's a limit to how much you can reduce the number of people on ships. I think actually that limit is lower than the number that we can reduce to is lower than perhaps John might think. And I think there are a lot of potential for improvement in those arenas, but that's a debate we could have. What's striking to me is if you look back, for example, at the accident report, evaluating three Navy collisions and one grounding in Asia over the course of this year, you see, first of all, the wear and tear on the personnel at present. But then you also see a comment from the report, I think it's on page 17, that says the modernization effects haven't been adequately funded, and we have an uneven pace of technology innovation. So when sailors move from one ship to another, they find themselves unfamiliar with the new technology they're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the accident on the McCain, for example, new sailors are arriving on the bridge with relatively little time and training to a system they're less familiar with. Mm-hmm. So part of this technology needs to be invested in all of the capabilities we've got technologically to enable our personnel to operate better. And this means some far-out stuff like using virtual reality and simulations and the like, but it also means some mundane stuff like standardizing and rapidly modernizing so we don't have, as we have at the moment, a fleet with 1 foot in the past and 1 foot trying to get into the future. So these things, in my opinion, are higher priorities that need to be dealt with in the near term than expanding over the next 20 and 30 years our numbers of ships.
Okay, thank
Kath,
you.
Can I have just one point on the technology point? Because this is, I mean, you've raised a critically important feature of the whole debate that really has to be reconciled, which is, by and large, the overwhelming percentage of the technology developed is used to enhance existing capability in order to make it perform in a different way, to get the next measure of performance out of it. And the focus is consistently there for exactly the same mentality I think that Richard emphasized, which is everybody looks at things platform-centric. How do I get the next margin of utility out of this? As opposed to the rare occasions we've seen in which there is complete product substitution, platform substitution, as a consequence of introduction of a new capability. And it happens from time to time. UAS, to be sure, is a case. Standoff weapons have demonstrated that. Stealth features, all of these different characteristics. But if we're really going to try to figure out how to avoid the kind of challenges that Richard's talking about that are really evident, and I concur entirely with him, in the accident reports of exactly how this went down and the inability to really prepare the crew each time for every one of those variants, that instead what we may be staring at more frequently is the coming to the gross realization of entire classes of capabilities can be substituted for something else, and actually making the decision to do so, which is bureaucratically, to borrow John's thought, a really difficult challenge, because everybody builds around that, they build around the product, and they build around the force.
Such a good point. I just have one question for you, which is, when I was secretary, why didn't you give me more advice?
Well, it cost me too much beer. What are you talking about? You already emphasized
secretary
that.
Secretary Layman, you want to jump in?
Yeah, both technology versus size are impossible to succeed in with the current procurement system we have. But Ash Carter, I think, set the standard in showing that if you have leaders that are prepared to apply common sense and cut through what is now, the actual statistics are it takes 22 and a half years now for an ACAT 1 or 2 program to go from, it takes 5 years just to get the requirements paper agreed through the DARS. And so it is taking us way too long. We deployed the F-22 with hardwired 286 architecture, probably the only system we have that can't be hacked by our potential enemies, because it took 24 years to go from the go-ahead to the first squadron IOC. We cannot continue to do this. It's impossible. The Ford carrier is, by most measures, about 3 times what the last, in constant dollars, Nimitz was. Same ship, but new technologies and so forth. Both building a ship, a fighter plane, or going to new technologies that could replace and will replace, in some cases, any of those. Going through the current system is a guarantee of our defeat. It's the best estimates of the intelligence community are that 22 and a half year cycle, which is normal for us, is a 7 year cycle now for the Russians, and roughly the same for the Chinese. Their ability to, because they both, through different means, got rid of a lot of their bureaucracy, and ours has just continued to grow. And it's really time that destroys the budgeting of the budgeting discipline. But it can be done. It can be effectively surmounted, as Ash Carter showed. And it's if we don't do that, if we don't bring competition in, if we don't bring shorter cycles, if we don't require every single program to have an equal say from every service because it's got to be joint, then we're doomed. We'll never be able to get beyond where we are now.
2009, we did a China Red Team on innovations the U.S. could undertake that would threaten, they would feel were threatening, and right at the top of the list was alter our acquisition system. So that tells you something right there. It's a strategic weakness. We're going to turn the floor over to Senator Warner, former Secretary of the Navy, in case you have a few words you'd like to say, Senator.
I'd like to have an assurance that as you reach this magical number, and I say that with great respect and thank you for the deliberation that each of you put in on this issue. For a long time, John was out there all by himself, but now you got alongside two very able hands with you. But the ever-changing threat, particularly from overhead systems to our systems on surface, Are you looking at a possibility of increasing subsurface systems in numbers to begin to hedge against the, whether it's cybersecurity or other weapons directed in on those surface targets and your deliberation? Did you consider that at all?
Well, just very quickly, I think that's one of the most promising areas that technology has opened up, that it's using technology that's available. Unmanned undersea systems have huge promise, but you're always going to have presence on the surface of the sea to transport troops and cargo and trade, and they've got to be protected, and they've got to be protected not only from underneath, but from above and from other surface ships. So the Navy has a very, very complicated challenge to do it, but you're absolutely right. Technology has really opened up in UAVs, particularly underwater UAVs, new opportunities at affordable prices.
If I can.
Yeah, please.
I completely agree. I think the logic you've laid out is just right, and with what you just said, John, as well. I just would note that technology is never constant, and what's true today may not be true tomorrow. I can imagine the evolution of artificial intelligence capabilities and improved sensors dramatically changing the capability to find submarines, even in a place like the Pacific. And this then would raise fundamental issues for our triad, our Navy, and so forth. So I'd always want to hedge to some degree, and I think that proposition is right today, but I would want to recognize it may not be right some decades from now.
Okay, we have a lot of questions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do two at a time and then throw it open and see what you'd like to answer from what's asked. So why don't we do these two right here in front? So we'll do Harlan first and then Sydney. No, right up here, Eric.
Kathy, you could actually save more time by having them speak in unison.
I'm Harlan Ullman. I want to draw on Richard Danzig's fire escape analogy at my point. I think, for three reasons I'd like you to comment on, that the issue is not going to be 350, it's going to be keeping what the Navy has today. The Armed Services Committee have come up with a $700 billion budget, which is not going to be sustained, which I argue is a floor, not a ceiling. Second, we have the issue, and John Layman suggested this, of uncontrolled or uncontrollable internal cost growth inside the Pentagon for everything from precision weapons till people of about 5 to 7% a year, which means you gotta bump up the budget between $30 and $50 billion every year just to stay even. And third, John described this Frankensteinian process that had to be designed by the KGB in terms of the budgeting, Budget Control Act, oversight regulation. In fact, when John was on the 9/11 Commission, I had asked him what was the biggest change he had seen in the 15 years since he left being Secretary of the Navy. And he said the regulatory process has become huge. It's gotten even worse. So how do you take on the reality of budget constraints, which are probably going to get worse, uncontrolled or uncontrollable internal cost growth, and this regulatory morass, which is just Frankensteinian?
Sydney.
A related and equally cheerful note. You said, you know, the industrial base is not a limiting factor, but I'd love you to break that down. I mean, presumably Halter Marine is not building CVNs, but, you know, what can you actually get out of these other yards? Where are they? You know, are we going to be, you know, building arsenal ships in Korea or, you know, missile boats in Shreveport? I mean, what kind of Navy can you actually build? It probably will look very different if you go to different yards, possibly even abroad.
And these are linked, so I'll throw it open.
Well, I'm
you
closest
start?
To you,
absolutely.
So I'll start.
Absolutely, thank you.
I mentioned that we owned four yards over the last 15 years or so. One was in Mobile. It was right next to the Austell Yard, which was a yard that had never built a ship. And it was created by the Australian firm Austell with General Dynamics oversight. And is now producing LCSs. And we were right next door to it. That yard, we made a lot of money on by repairing and subcontracting with commercial shipbuilders, and a little bit of, but very profitable money repairing Navy ships. That was the yard that turned out one T1 tanker a week during World War II, with Hank Aaron as its most prominent employee. But the graving docks are still there. All the cutting sheds and the derricks and the cranes and the infrastructure is now all modern. It's all computer controlled. It could, like that, recruit or borrow or partner with a contractor that had had the necessary software engineering and the basic facility if there was a possibility to compete. The biggest missing factor today is there's no competition. I mean, it's everything's cost plus, and the bureaucracy has its favored contractors, and they get awarded theoretically fixed price incentive contracts, but they're really cost plus, and that drives the cost. There are no constraints on it, and it also constrains the innovation and in infusion of new technology. So then we owned the yard in Philadelphia that built the Iowa, in the old Philadelphia Navy Yard. The European Norwegian company has come in and turned it into one of the most modern commercial shipbuilding yards in the world. And they're making nice profit, of course, on Jones Act ships, but still producing a very fine product. All the equipment is there. They have all the trades. If they were allowed to bid, they could. And first of all, one of the main reasons yards like that don't bid is because they know that the Pentagon system is out of control. I mean, when we build our Hawaii Super Ferry, same size as the LCS, in a shed 150 feet from the first LCS, we produced two ships roughly the same size, on time, on budget. We had two change orders through the entire program. Right next to it, the LCS averaged 75 change orders a week. And so it overran by 400% and took three times as long to go. So I want to go back to Ash Carter. I mean, Ash can be a real example. If you're prepared to take on the bureaucracy and cut through it and cut out lots of people, because his program, when he initiated the various permutations of the emergent requirements program, added averaged from start to deployment 401 days, not 22 and a half years, because he had the power to grant waivers. Well, his pen got very tired. He told me he spent 90% of his time granting waivers to the DAR. Well, that can be fixed. All of this is fixable. But if we just say the process is the process, we have to accept that everything's going to overrun and that carriers cost three times what they used to, and then you can't do it. You're not going to be able to do it. But we can fix it quickly.
Richard, I think you wanted to add something.
I do, but I think maybe you want to get more questions in, so I can wait.
Okay, all right, we're going to do a final round of two questions. I have very enthusiastic folks over here, so since they're sitting next to each other, we'll do the same thing, and I apologize we couldn't get more in. Wait for the mic. Sorry. Yep, okay. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. We've got a number of our allies here, so we're talking about a 350.
You should introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. Kevin Wensing, retired Navy captain. We have a number of our allies with us today. We're talking about a 300-ship Navy. How can we encourage and, you know, use technology to enhance our allies so we have, you know, people talked about a 1,000-ship Navy in the past?
Sam Tangredi. I've got a ton of questions, but I'll be really quick. Going to the 75 change orders, I wonder from your gentleman's perspective, what do you think drives that 75 change orders? Is it because we can't get the requirements right? Is it because we train acquisition professionals wrong? Or is it because the leadership is changing its mind? What causes the 75 versus the two?
I think, you know, the most dominant reason for that as why it occurs, why the change order frequency happens, is the mindset is once we have this platform approved and we're going to get a program, this is it. We better put in as much to this as we can accommodate, because we're not going to see this again for a while. There's not going to be a new opportunity. So the pressure on program managers, on, you know, et cetera, have derived from all the requirements determination process is that you better drive in every capability you ever dreamed of, and as a result, it comes up with more and more frequency to do this. In addition to that, and I think, you know, John's inference here is there's a tendency to try to make up for what you didn't cover the first time by a change order moving forward. That's always there. And it's a discipline of saying, I'm going to freeze this particular design standard and say that's the way it's going to look on the way out the door, is the same way it started at the front end. And the only way you can get away with doing that is to not resign yourself to the fact that it's going to take you 20 plus years. Okay. You've got to have a period of time that's going to be short enough that you can envision where that would go, and that will minimize the propensity to think that this is the only platform, I better get it all onto this one, and this is my last chance because it won't be coming around again. You'll change that viewpoint pretty quickly if you can manage to what you're always talking about.
I would agree with that, and I think the three of us think very similarly on this point, but I would offer a different solution to the problem you identify, Sean. The optimal is to create a platform that's adaptable and that you can innovate with as it develops in service, and then you don't have it frozen, but on the other hand, you don't have to jam everything in the early stage. This is a lot easier with software than with hardware. I mean, a fundamental problem for our acquisition system is hardware is hard. And if you look at the great examples of innovation out there, there are the Apples and so on that traffic in hardware as well as software, but most of them are software companies. DoD has it harder. But we still screw it up in a lot of ways, in part because we came to fall into the habits that John identified when he said, the Soviet Union would follow us. So if really the Soviet Union is following us and we take 20 years, they'll take 20 years or 25. And we could do it in that world. But in our present world, we've never faced an opponent that came close to having our GDP in our modern times. Nazi Germany didn't. The Soviet Union's at a third of our GDP. Andy Krepinevich has some good work on this. I'm struck by the fact that it's not just that the projections show that in the next decade, China will come to equal our GDP. I'm struck by the fact that the projections suggest that in 2050, it'll have a GDP 50% greater. So if you take John's point that the technology competitors are coming closer to us and will follow us closely, in fact, in that world, they're likely to outpace us. And a critical issue will be, can we absorb the technology more imaginatively and more rapidly than they can? Not that we've got some secret sauce, but that we figure out how to cook the meal a whole lot better and get it out of the kitchen sooner. And that's something that, in fact, we haven't focused on nearly enough. And the cry that John and Sean raise, which I echo, hey, this needs to be a priority for our leaders, is absolutely right.
Yeah, and I agree with everything that my two good friends have said, at least in this response. And, but
we'll hear
the
about
larger
this later,
issue,
sure.
The reason that these cupidities are indulged is because of the insane joint system that has been imposed now on procurement. It's just crazy. You have every COCOM has a JROC, a Joint Requirements Staff. The JROC bureaucracy and the Joint Chiefs would fill the whole building if it were in the same building. And so everybody's got a say. There are lots of anecdotes, I'm sure, if you talk to the parade of failed program managers in the LCS program, that in fact, one of the crucial things that ruined the monohull, requiring a 43 knot top speed, which forced them into this kludge of a combining gearbox and a lot of other things. That came from two determined Army colonels from UCOM. And everybody gets a say now. Everything's by committee, and nobody's held accountable because they can't be held accountable because they're just one of 40 review groups. That it doesn't have to be that way. We don't need laws changed. The Armed Services Committee in the DCAA that was passed in the House yesterday by an overwhelming vote, 240-70 or something, showing consensus it's time to build, it gives the last two before this one and the one that's about to be passed in the Senate and then already passed the House, provide a whole new foundation if the leaders in the Pentagon will use it, because they incorporated a lot of the lessons learned from Bob Work's work and Ash Carter's work and lessons from further back, so that they've restored the chiefs, the service chiefs, to accountability and authority within the procurement system, which they were out for the last 30 years and had little say in. They've done all the things that can enable a real leader who isn't afraid and believes that he or she has to observe everything in the DAR and follow the process, because you won't get in trouble if you follow the 22 and a half year process. But now they've got the way to go through that and get back to a 6-year cycle. It took us, our distinguished chairman was alive at the time when we built the Polaris system in 4 years from the back of an envelope to the first deployment of the George Washington, the most complex system we've ever deployed. And we did it with slide rules in 4 years. And now we can't even get an APC out in less than 22 and a half years if you follow the rules. Sorry. I'm sort of the crazy uncle in the attic.
No. Well, we are beyond time, and I would like to keep going, and I definitely wish we had had time to address the allies and partners piece. But I think what that means is that we would love to have you all back next year for a reprise. That was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Sorry, and a fresh round of applause. Please join me in thanking these former secretaries of the Navy for their service and for joining us here today.